It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, in the wake of a tragedy, real, heroic men. Two, the meaning of life, Donald Trump. Three, opening day for Major League Baseball, predictions with Ben Verlander. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment. Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. Let's dive deep. Get ready for opening day. The good, the bad, and the ugly of Major League Baseball. Rules changes and predictions with Fox Sports analyst Ben Verlander. But first, story number one. An absolutely tragic day in Nashville, Tennessee. I don't really know how, once again, to go through the details of a story of another school shooting. The Covenant Christian School in Nashville, Tennessee, was the target of a shooter, Audrey Hale. Audrey Hale entered the Covenant Christian School and killed 3 children and 3 adults. Hale, it has now been revealed, self-identifies as a man, is transgender. And you know, I don't think this needs to be the focus of our conversation, but I also don't think it can go unnoticed. I do my best. I took a walk with my wife this morning and talked once again about one of these horrific incidences. And I said, I always want to fight for my better angel. You know, whenever there is a mass shooting, I think there is a proclivity. I do think it's common on the left to blame your political opponents for the acts of a deranged individual, to take whatever some horrific person has done and try to attach their motives to the positions of your political opponent, whether or not it's rhetoric or whether or not it's policy. And I think it a unique trick that in the wake of this shooting in Nashville, that many on the left look at a trans school shooter attacking a Christian school and see, oh, look, it's the policies of the right. The conversation today for much of the left, for the president of the United States, Joe Biden, is once again about gun control. But we will readily look into the motives of a school shooter, of a terrorist, and attach that, give it much deeper meaning if, for example, a Dylann Roof makes a racist attack in South Carolina. You say, oh, but Will, a man who would shoot up people in Buffalo targeting black people and leaves behind a manifesto, leaves behind a clear motivation. And from that motivation, we can see his inspiration. And there is your politics. I think that is unfair. I think that is standing on the graves of dead people, in the worst case, standing on the graves of children to accomplish a political win. So I want to fight for my better angel today. When you look at this and say, can I take this deranged individual and learn something greater about their motivations that applies to our culture? I want to appeal to my better angel not to do that which is, in my mind, wrong of my opponent. But I also think that I can't let something go completely unnoticed. I think when you look at this transgender individual, this woman, Audrey Hale, who I think had begun to go by the name Aiden Hale, you can't ignore the some larger cultural cancers. You know, in the beginning of this incident, almost every media outlet reported that it was a female. It's of note because it's so rare. The vast majority of mass shooters are men. And to see that it was a woman was of note, and it was in everyone's notes. It was in everyone's media report. And then, oddly, after a police press conference, it started to come out, this person self-identified was as a man, was transgender. And then later, which we haven't yet seen, also had a manifesto along with a map of the school. And then the reporting begins to change. And then the reporting begins to use the school shooter's preferred pronouns. And I think it's fascinating what changed. Think about that for just one moment. What changed? No biological reality. Nothing you would find in an autopsy. No genetic code. The only thing that changed is the wishes of the school shooter. The identity of the school shooter. To me, that sort of is naked. It lays bare the fraudulence of the entire enterprise of preferred pronouns. There's something about that shift that not only tells you that it's a fiction, but it tells you that the entire movement is a fiction. Let me explain. There have been some that I noticed, and I'm going to neglect to use names or even channels, but there have been some that I have noticed who, in a change, declined to use the school shooter's preferred pronouns. That's almost of more interest to me. Of course, like any principle, you can only find principles in consistency. I gave a statement a few weeks ago on Fox and Friends, disconnected obviously from this news story, where I said, I will use the preferred proper name of anyone. If Cassius Clay wants to be called Muhammad Ali, I will call him Muhammad Ali. If there is an Audrey who wants to be called Aiden, I will call that person Aiden. But I will not change my usage of pronouns. I will accommodate your subjective realm, but I will not change objective reality. That is my consistent principle. So I find it interesting of note in a indictment of our culture, not just those that changed their reporting based upon the shooter's desires, but also those who would not change based upon the shooter's desires, inconsistently would not change based upon the shooter's desires. What I mean is, not my position, perhaps not your position, that I will always use the genetic biological grounding of someone's pronouns, but rather individuals who in the past would accommodate a transgender person's preferred pronouns, but now that that person has turned into a horrific school shooter, will not accommodate their pronouns. The newscaster that today, where in the past would have said he, him for Aiden Hale, today, because Aiden Hale, Audrey Hale, killed 6 people in a school shooting, will all of a sudden now retether themselves to reality and stick with she, her. Why? Is it because this transgender person did not earn the right to circumvent, to subvert reality? Because they're so bad, they've lost the privilege of changing everyone else's objective reality? It's something interesting to note and to ask anyone who has changed their position in relationship to this story. Objective reality has no, it does not bend to the will of anyone's subjective desires, nor to the horrific nature of objective reality. It just is. And Audrey Hale was female when she walked into that shooting, and she was female when she was laying dead on the floor of Covenant Christian after having killed 6 individuals. That is objective reality. I also think you can't divorce this from the fact that on April 1st, there is a scheduled Trans Day of Vengeance to take place in Washington, D.C., in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. You can see the flyer. It's posted all over social media. Can you think of another civil rights movement that has truly leaned into the idea of vengeance? Now, even when the Black Panthers were part of the civil rights movement, they were an outlier in the movement. The push was for equality. The trans movement has quickly emerged from obscurity, forced itself onto center stage, commanded the spotlight, and quickly metastasized into the motivation of vengeance. Is that healthy? Is that going to be something that produces a movement completely divorced from violence? Did we not see here today with Audrey Hale some desperate attempt at vengeance? Every other civil rights movement has sought to bring their movement to the mainstream, to bring someone left to the margins into equality. With the trans movement, what is unique about the trans movement is not just a search for equality, not even a search for acceptance, not a search for tolerance, but a push, a target, a motive of force. It's not about simply achieving equal rights. It's about changing your rights. It's about changing the way you speak. It's about changing the way you think. It's about altering objective reality. It is inherently forceful to ask, no, to require another human being to use your preferred pronoun, to change your objective reality. And if this movement continues to push into center stage with vengeance, then it will court this kind of tragedy. Now, in the wake of this kind of tragedy, what we can see, what is almost impossible to ignore, what has to be celebrated, is the role of heroic men. It does not escape my attention that at the end of this tragedy, what we have is devastation by someone pretending to be a man, while it was brought to an end by people living up to the values, the reality of being a man. The Nashville Police Department has covered itself in glory, and it is in stark contrast to what we saw in Uvalde, Texas. There's body cam footage out there. I would highly encourage you to go wherever you must, social media, to find it. I think you will be able to find something between 7 and 9 minutes worth of footage, body cam footage, from the likes of Rex Engelbert and Michael Colazzo, two heroes in Nashville. What you will see is pure competence, action-oriented, direct, calm. These officers roll up onto the scene and within 4 minutes have taken down the shooter. They pull up in their car. You can see this in Rex Engelbert's body cam. He gets out. He immediately moves to the back of his car in almost as swift as a motion possible, pulls out his assault rifle. He then moves while receiving instructions from some type of school administrator about where and what is going on. He calmly says, okay, thank you. Yes, got it. Yes, ma'am, he says as he moves his way to the door. Once he gets to the door, you will hear him say, I need three. I need three. He says it directly. It's a command. He says it no more than three times. I need three. From that point, you see three in camera men begin to go through the building and clear rooms one after another. No hesitation, barking commands at one another. Cool, calm, no hesitation. Engelbert goes door to door clearing rooms. He seems to be one of the primary breachers. I don't know all of the terms. I think they refer to him as an LRB in this footage. I know that because later you see footage in real time from Michael Collazo's body cam. Collazo, to me, is a true leader in this moment. I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert, but just the tone of his voice as he goes through this, absolute resolve as he tells his fellow officers, go, go, go. To the right. Lead with your rifle. I'm with you. Keep pushing. Part of this team that now includes Engelbert as they go hallway to hallway, room to room, finally stairwell to stairwell before they find Audrey Hale. When they get there, Collazo waves Engelbert forward, says, I'm clearing for LRB. Engelbert comes around the final corner. He's the first to turn the last corner and immediately engages Hale. Several shots, and she's down. Collazo takes command, leadership yelling at Hale to stop moving, stop touching the weapon. It is awe-inspiring. There is not a door that they hesitated to go through. There's not a corner they hesitated to turn. It's direct. It's confident. It's calm. It's selfless. It's practiced. It's trained. It's masculine. This is the behavior. Everyone wonders who they would be in this moment. Wonder no more, Nashville. This is the behavior of a real man.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Story number two. Donald Trump. It's back in the news. Did he ever leave? It's really fascinating to see the hunger for Donald Trump. Donald Trump gave a rally in Waco, Texas, where once again he commanded an audience of thousands. He also gave an interview to Sean Hannity this past week. I was on Media Buzz with Howard Kurtz, and the topic was Donald Trump and the press's obsession with Donald Trump. I took a moment, and I really like doing the show. These days, it's one of the places where I have the most opportunity to debate somebody from the left. And on this day, it was Leslie Marshall. But I did, and I like Howard Kurtz a lot because I think he is wide open to his own self-criticism, as we all should be. And I said, Howard, I just want to be clear about something. 17 minutes into this show, all we've talked about is Donald Trump. I truly think that at this point in time, Donald Trump is not just a national obsession. I think he's given far too many meaning. On Saturday night, I was watching the Elite Eight. Texas would take the floor the next night on Sunday. By the way, I was down, remember? I'm back up because now I'm talking about the transfer portal window, five-star recruits. Rodney Terry's got his contract as a full-time coach for the Longhorns. I'm back, baby. I'm an inherent optimist with big valleys of pessimism in my life. But spend 80% of my time in grounded in optimism. I'm back. But I was watching whoever it was on Saturday night in the Elite Eight, scrolling Twitter as I sometimes do when I watch sports. So I'm looking, and I follow a lot of political accounts, and I'm just shocked at how many are tweeting about Donald Trump in that moment. Okay, not everybody's into sports. This is a big political moment. You know, it's a huge rally on his path to 2024. But it really wasn't his supporters who I was taken by. It was his detractors. And a lot of them, you know who have derived the most meaning from Donald Trump? Never Trump. I mean, I'm talking about former conservatives. Some of them, former friends, who went the way of opposing Trump. Who were back, baby, in the same way I'm back with the University of Texas. They're back, baby, being given meaning because he's back. Trump. They were tweeting. They were tuned in. They were watching the rally. They were commenting. They're back in their element. He has given them the meaning of life. There's so much going on in this country And I do not suggest to you that Donald Trump is not a big part of our conversation in this country. But there's so much going on in this country, within and without politics. To think that on the night of the Elite Eight, you could once again, and I'm not, forget the Elite Eight, whatever, Saturday night, whatever you want to do to spend your time. If you are obsessed with politics, all that's wrong right now, all that needs to be fixed. But to go back and play, it's like someone who says, hey, it's Saturday night. What do you want to do? Well, I don't know. Why don't we play that song that we've been listening to for the last 8 years? I hate that song. Let's play that one again. Again, not people who love the song, people that hate the song. You want to watch a movie? No. You want to talk about politics? No. You want to watch basketball? No. What do you want to do? I want to play that song that you and I abhor. Oh, sounds like a great Saturday. They have been given their meaning once again because he's back. Donald Trump.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Story number three. Ben Verlander is a Fox Sports Major League Baseball analyst. And opening day is tomorrow in Major League Baseball. I'm headed out to Globe Life Park in Arlington to watch Jacob DeGrom pitch for the Texas Rangers. But before I do, before we kick off on a 162-game regular season schedule, I thought, well, let's get ready for MLB. Let's have Ben Verlander play good, bad, and ugly. Let's have him give us our predictions. Who's going to be the best teams in the National League? Who's going to be the best teams in the American League? Why are certain franchises better than others? Who's the best player? Maybe in the conversation of all time in Major League Baseball. And what about all of the rule changes? A pitch clock, shadow runners on the bases, doing away with the shift. What's good, bad, and ugly about Major League Baseball with Ben Verlander? All right, Ben, what's up? I'm just sitting here right before you jump on. I'm reading all of these 2023 predictions for Major League Baseball. And I'm thinking, all right, how do I go about this with Ben? How do I get my arms around this next season without spending the entire conversation talking about the Texas Rangers? So I think what I want to do is this, man. I want to do like good, bad, and ugly with you. We can walk through everything in baseball, I think, through these three choices. Who's going to be good? Who's going to be bad? What's ugly and should not be part of the game? And I think in order to start, we probably should start with what's going to be different about the game. Let's talk about the rule changes and whether or not you think they are good, bad, or ugly.
I'm mostly going to go good here. I think ultimately the game of baseball needs change, as with everything. Things evolve over time. You got to keep up with the times, and baseball's been the worst at actually doing that. It's like their feet are stuck in the sand, and they haven't wanted to change because it's America's pastime. But I think eventually things need to evolve, and baseball's doing that. And I think in 5 months or 5 years or 10 years, things will look different than they do right now. But this is the beginning of change. I'm for these rules. I think ultimately they'll be great for the sport and getting more action on the field. And I love it. I'm good.
All of them? You like the pitch clock? You like the banishment of the shift? You like the phantom runner? What do you like every new gimmick? You just want innovation?
No, so I don't love the way they all are currently. I think they all are going in the right direction. I don't love that the pitch clock is as fast as it is. I wish it were bumped up a little bit. And I don't have all the answers here, but I don't love that. You know, I understand it for the regular season, but a lot of the drama that builds in postseason baseball comes about in those, you know, in that time in between pitches and a big batter at the plate against a team's best closer. And, you know, it is going to take away from it a little bit if it's a 15-second pitch clock and then a strike is called or a ball is called because of the pitch clock. I don't love that. So I do feel like there needs to be tweaks involved with the pitch clock. All in all, I think it'll ultimately be good. With the restriction of the shift, I am completely for that. I think, you know, and this is a switch for me. I used to say, well, you have nine defenders, put them wherever you want. That's the game. But again, things do evolve, and, you know, you can't tell a hitter when 100 miles an hour is coming in to, oh, just hit it the other way. Doesn't exactly work like that. So what I started thinking of is you look at every sport, you know, think of the rules that they've had to implement to evolve the sport. Imagine if there was a guy like Shaquille O'Neal that was just able to stand under the basket for the 24 seconds and catch it and put it in. No, he has to move outside of the paint. And with football, you have to line up a certain way. So I think ultimately it will promote more offensive balls in play, which we were getting more and more and more towards the three true outcomes of a homer, a strikeout, or a walk. I think guys will put the ball in play more. I think that'll be good. Runner on second, the ghost runner. I don't love it. I get it. I think the players in a 162-game season are on the mindset of let's just get this going. We don't want to play 20 innings in the middle of August on a Wednesday night. So I do understand that one. But as far as the new rule changes this year, I'm good with those.
Okay, I want to talk about the new rule changes through three different lenses. So let me start with selfish. But you know what? Here's the interesting. First of all, imagine you get tired of this because you love baseball. You're engrossed in baseball, and the premise of the conversation often around baseball is what's wrong with baseball. How can we fix baseball? So that probably gets tiresome. But you know, the pitch clock, for example. I think you're right. There's a rhythm to baseball that's going to now be disrupted, but you kind of have to start with, yeah, but something's not quite right with baseball. It's not quite as popular as it once was. It's losing. You hate to sort of bend to a culture that requires you to deliver every piece of entertainment in 15-second increments, but, you know, it's like, I think, for example, on the pitch clock, I think that's something that's going to help address, and I don't want to over-characterize this, what's wrong with baseball?
No, I get what you're saying. And look, the diehard baseball fans aren't going to go anywhere because there's a pitch clock. They love the sport. They love the game of baseball. They might not love this rule. They might be frustrated by it. But they're still going to turn on their TV and watch their favorite players and watch their sport that they love to watch. What I do think this does is cater to another audience, a younger audience that baseball desperately has needed. And it's starting to do that, I think. And in the age of social media and short attention spans, it's all about how much action can you give me in a short amount of time. And yeah. I would go to a baseball game and watch a four-hour baseball game, but I think I'm probably in the top percentage of Americans that love the game of baseball. Like, my love of baseball could hardly get much higher, you know? But there is a percentage of people that say, well, the game's just, like, I like baseball. It's just, it's long, and there's a lot of just sitting there and not a ton of action at times. And, you know, whether I agree or disagree with that doesn't really matter. That is the case. There are people, and a strong majority of people, that feel that way. And this addresses that to a degree. And this, I know from people that haven't been huge baseball fans that are talking about this, they're excited about it. I've seen people say, I'm going to go to games again. So it's not less action. We're getting more action in a less amount of time. So it does address a need for baseball, which is to evolve, to get away from, to get younger, to get a younger audience involved. And I think this is a good start.
You know, I think I've heard Colin Cowherd say this. It's not about the length of time something is, but actually how entertaining it is within that time. In other words, if you have a really good movie, you don't sit there at the 2.5-hour mark and go, gosh, this needs to be over. I think I disagree with him to some extent. I think I disagree, though, because there's that entertainment maxim, always leave them wanting more. And I don't think baseball is alone. Like, I love college football. It's too long. Games are entirely too long. One game is an entire Saturday. So I kind of get what you're coming from. We get the same amount of action in a shorter amount of time. Leave them wanting more. But okay, real quick on the rules to stay with this. Here's how I consume baseball, Ben. And I think that I could be wrong, but I think I'm somewhat representative. I joked about the Texas Rangers. That's my prism because I'm a fan. So what I do is I keep up with my team. It's true in everything. It's true in all sports. Football's the one great exception, the NFL particularly, where we keep up with teams that aren't our teams. We can tell you who we think the top five quarterbacks are, even though they may be in an entirely separate conference. So when I look at the shift, for example, By the way, I think you're 100% right about putting balls in play. We forgot how exciting that is. Like just moving base runners as opposed to that's much more fun than home runs. If you'd asked us 10 years ago, we would never have known that, but we found it out. It's true. It's way better than a home run to move runners. But I read Corey Seager is going to be one of the best beneficiaries of getting away, doing away with the shift. And so here's my personal prism, my selfish prism for Corey Seager and the Texas Rangers. And I'm like, all right, I'm done. Good. No more shift.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so there are certain guys that it's really going to benefit. A guy like Corey Seager, big time benefit there. I'm interested to watch, speaking of your Rangers, he's not there anymore, but Joey Gallo, like how does he benefit from this? Because it's almost like his style of play has been phased out of the game of baseball over the last few years, and we've seen him struggle exponentially over the last couple of years. So I'm excited to watch those guys. I'm excited to watch guys not just try and hit homers because they know, well, if I hit it on the ground, I'm going to be out. So there's no point in hitting the ball on the ground. I think that's going to completely change. I think we're going to see a vastly different sport in a good way. That's why I'm all in on these rules. If I had to change some, sure, I could give my opinion on how to change some. But all in all, I think it's going to be great for the sport. And we've seen it in spring training. We've seen so many hits that would have been outs and so many swings that guys wouldn't have been taking previously. And we've seen guys stealing bases because the bases are a little bit bigger, meaning they're closer together, and we've seen tons of stolen bases. The game of baseball in spring training is fun and exciting, and whether you like the pitch clock or not, people are tuning in to be like, oh my god, this game is rolling along. This is crazy to watch, and the shift is really going to benefit guys like Corey Seager, like you mentioned, and I'm excited to see the kind of year they have.
Okay, let's do good, bad, and ugly on some teams. So let's do the National League. I think there actually maybe, I don't know, maybe more teams to discuss in the National League. Who do you think, like, really good? We don't have to go division by division on winners of each division, but, like, when it comes to the end of the year, and we're talking about the playoffs and who's advancing, who are the, you know, two, three teams that you think will be there in the National League?
You know, the National League is interesting to me because I'm no betting expert. But I would bet that I know right now the six teams that are going to make the playoffs in the National League. And I can't say that in the American League. I would say you're going to get the division winners, obviously, are the three. Let's say I have the Padres winning the NL West. So let's say the Padres, and then in the Central you have the Cardinals, and in the NL East you have either the Braves or the Mets or the Phillies, whoever it may be.
Well, you have
all
the Braves number two in your power rankings.
I would tell you right now.
So I assume the Braves. I said you have the Braves number two in your power rankings. So I assume the Braves.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of the Braves this year. They look great. So I would tell you right now, the six teams that I think are absolutely going to make the playoffs in the National League are three teams from the NL East: the Braves, the Mets, and the Phillies. The winner of the NL Central is four, most likely the Cardinals. I think they're a little bit better. And then the two teams in the NL West: the Dodgers and the Padres. And I don't really see a ton of other room for other teams. I do think there are teams that have gotten so much better this offseason in the National League. I think the Cubs have gotten a lot better. Do I think they're a playoff team? No. I think the Diamondbacks are heading in the right direction. Do I think they can beat out the Padres or the Dodgers? No, I don't. And I don't see who's going to beat out those three teams in the NL East. So I think the National League is pretty set when you look at the teams that are going to make it.
Yeah, but among those six teams, do you think that now that you sort of elected your tier one teams, are they all kind of on equal playing field then once it comes down to it, or do you see one or two head and shoulders above the others? Like, and then let me ask you a two-parter. When do the Padres live up to their roster?
Yeah, that's kind of the question, right? It feels like the last, I don't want to say few years, but at least the last couple of years, it's been like, is this the year for the Padres? And the answer, until arguably this past year when they finally got over the hump of the Dodgers and beat them in the playoffs, was no. But now, a team getting into the playoffs, the Padres getting into the playoffs and winning one series ain't going to cut it. When you look at the amount of money they're spending, the star-studded roster they have, for them to this year, for them to be a success is being in the World Series, winning a World Series. And I think they have that capability, but the question still, as you asked, is like, when are they going to live up to the potential of their roster? Because I don't think we've seen that yet. But I put them in that elite tier I would put the Braves and the Mets in that elite tier, and then the other teams just a step under that. Dodgers, Phillies, Cardinals are probably right under there. I was pretty disappointed with what the Dodgers did this offseason, so I can't put them in that top tier.
You didn't even mention, right, again, you didn't even mention the team you have number two in all of baseball, not even the National League, the Braves.
I said the Padres, the Braves, and the Mets in the top tier.
I thought you said Phillies. Okay, all right, good. I'm just looking for inconsistencies. I just want to be as mad at you as Twitter is on as many occasions as possible. Okay, let's go over to the American League. Who's really good?
The Astros. The Astros are far and away the best team in the American League. I think they're in a tier of their own. And then if I had to look for like almost in that top tier, I would put the Blue Jays there this year. I think the Blue Jays are fantastic. I think the Yankees and Blue Jays are probably right around the same area. But the Yankees are now dealing with so many injuries that who knows, like, what's the deal with Rodon this year? Is when Severino coming back? So I think the Astros are in the tier by themselves, and then there's a few teams right under that.
Hey, Ben, what happened with, I mean, we're going back several years now. I used to have a show on ESPN on a daily basis, and we talked about the Astros. They were already at the top, and they were dealing with the cheating scandal. I can't remember how many years we have to go back. The Astros tanked at the beginning of this run, right, for a bit. Like, how did they build an organization the way that they have where it has remained? What are we on? Are we on like a 5 or 6 year run now for the Astros after the tank? And I mean, like, it's the class of Major League Baseball. Why?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a combination of everything. You can say, like, yeah, they were awful for a few years and tanked and got a bunch of first draft picks, but we've seen that with other teams. We've seen other teams try and do that. And, you know, teams like the Pirates and, you know, the A's. But it takes like a combination of an owner that wants to win and is willing to go all in when the time is right, as well as a scouting department and an analytics department that is above and beyond. And I know from when my brother first went to Houston from Detroit, I just remember us talking about how he was blown away by how they prepare players analytically for success. You know, like, he would come over as, I don't know, arguably a Hall of Famer at that point in his career. Probably not yet. I think the couple of Cy Youngs officially got him there. But, you know, on a Cy Young or on a Hall of Fame track when he got to Houston, and he got there, and they were immediately like, hey, you don't do this well, and you do this really well, but you don't do it often. This is what you're going to do more and more and more of. And if we could get into specifics of that, but essentially, since he's gotten to Houston or went to Houston, he started pitching up in the zone with his fastball far more because the analytics said your fastball has a ton of ride on it. That's what you should be doing. And that's what they do with all of their players. They find what they're the best at, and they tell them to go do that. And it might sound easy. It might sound like a simple thought to do, but it's not, and not a lot of organizations know to do that or can do that. The Astros are one of them. The Rays are one of them. But they find what guys are best at and put them into positions of success on top of drafting really good talent, on top of having an owner that's willing to go all in when the time is right. And you combine all of those things, and you have a team that is literally in the midst of a dynasty at this point.
Right. No, right. But there was something interesting you said in there. So your brother, as you mentioned, was already on a Hall of Fame trajectory before getting to the Astros. Pretty interesting psychological test there. You know, you're doing pretty well, and then you go into an organization that says, here's what you don't do well. Here's what you do well. And we have the numbers to show it. Was that hard for Justin? That's got to be... And the answer is going to be different for every human being, right? Every human being is going to look at the nerds and go, what are you talking about? Or, oh, that's fascinating. I could be better. I mean, was that hard for Justin?
I think it was. I think he is very much so the latter. I don't think it was hard for him at all. I think he thrives on that sort of stuff. He's always looking for the next leg to be great. And to be honest with you, the end of his tenure in Detroit wasn't the easiest. The team had started to struggle. He wasn't pitching as he as he could have been or as he was years prior. So I think it all happened at the perfect time where he ends up on the move, ends up in a new organization. And when he gets there, they're saying all these things. And my brother more so is the most competitive person that I've ever been around. And he always wants to be the best, always thinks there's room for improvement, no matter whether he's 40 years old and about to start a tenure with a new team. There's always room for improvement. And the second he got to Houston and they said, "Hey man, glad you're here. We want you to start doing this more, and here's the numbers behind it." So I think that's, you know, to your question, I'm sure there's guys that they're like, "No, this is the way I've been doing it." And maybe egos come along a little bit. But when you have numbers and like proof right in front of you, it's hard to argue with that. You know, when a team says, "Hey, this is what you're best at. Here's the proof. And if you do this more, you'll have more success." I mean, it would have to take a pretty stubborn person to be like, "Nah, I'm good." You know, and he wasn't like that.
Yeah, well, we consider and say that might sound odd, but are most people stubborn? I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Staying on the organizational thing for just 1 minute. You know, being real with you, Ben, like, again, I like baseball. It's primarily through the prism of my local team, and it has been for quite some time. My local team was not good for most of the past decade. Starting in, 13, 14. The interesting thing about the Astros is, if I look at consistency, the reason I bring up how much I pay attention to, but I think for a while now we've seen the Dodgers, we've seen the Yankees, we've seen the Phillies, the Braves have had some ups and downs, but they've kind of been consistently up there. I'm just looking at the organizations. You mentioned the Rays. The Rays are interesting because they're not a big money franchise. I'm trying to look for a correlation, a consistency, because there's a little turnover, but there's also some organizations that seem to stay up there, and if they do go down, come back up quickly. And the easiest explanation is money in baseball. That's the easiest explanation. But I guess that's not... That may be the primary distinguishing factor, because all of those are big markets, the ones we mentioned, except for the Rays. The Astros weren't traditionally one of those franchises. I'm just asking you, what is it about all these organizations that they continue to stay? And now I'm thinking, well, the Royals had their run as well, and they don't fit the profile. So what is it, in your estimation, Ben?
I think it's, one, an ownership and a front office that wants to win. And it might sound dumb to say that, but it's true. And I can point to you right now some organizations that I don't think are all in on winning and don't really care. The Oakland A's, Pittsburgh Pirates, Cincinnati Reds. I think what they're doing right now is a disservice to the game. And I think having an owner in place that wants to win and wants to win in the moment goes a long way. So I think it starts with the ownership, how much money you're pumping into a team. Now, is it realistic for a team like the Kansas City Royals to spend money like the New York Yankees? Probably not. I don't think that's the case, but you can still have an owner that wants to buy in, which is why you see a team like the Royals able to have that run that they did for a few years, and then the Yankees constantly able to be there because they can constantly spend that much. Whereas the Royals, on the other hand, it's like, this is our window. We have this 4-year window, 5-year window, whatever it may be. We're going to spend as best as we can in that time. So there's the recipe for success for smaller market teams, if you will. Whereas the Yankees can constantly just spend money and be there, right? Like, they can go get the Aaron Judges of the world in free agency, the Carlos Rodons of the world in free agency, and be there. Whereas other teams, it kind of takes more of a combination of that. Like I just mentioned with the Astros. The ability to draft, the ability to have an analytical department, the ability to have an owner that will buy in at the right time. The Rays are an interesting one because I think they have two of the three of those. I think they have an organization that is elite analytically. I think they have the great ability to draft. I don't think that they have an owner that's willing to go all in and do things the right way when they need to, and when their time arises, which is why we haven't been able to see them get over that hump, which is, you can be successful for a 10-year period, but can you win the World Series against the teams like the Astros or the Dodgers when they're spending, or teams like that? So it's interesting in baseball because I think it takes a culmination of a lot of different things.
Yeah, and I like what you said. I mean, I think that's clearly right. It's the building the baseline, the foundation, if you can set in place the analytics and so forth, drafting well, and then when your window comes, being willing to go in and shove the chips into the table. So let's take 1 minute now, 2 minutes, and talk about my team because we didn't really go deep. I'll tell you the sentiment here in Texas. It is, wow, we've been a disappointment for so long. We have big market capabilities, big market money, have never lived up to being able to spend like other big markets. But the feeling is, like, what are we looking at? 3-4 years of pretty good drafting, a farm system that's really good. We may not, so good, bad, ugly. We may not be good this year. We might actually still be bad to some extent, but we're a year or two away from actually being really good.
Yeah, I think that makes it hard for me if I'm going to go good, bad, ugly. You know, like, I think you asked me this question. If you were to say good, bad, or ugly in 2 years, I'm going to say great. That's where I think they're heading. I mean, this year, I think you probably got to put them somewhere in between. But if you make me pick, probably the bad category because I don't think they make the playoffs. But this is a team, and it's really interesting with the Rangers because, you know, we can talk about the ability to draft correctly and then getting ownership buy-in at the right time. I feel like the Rangers aren't getting the credit they deserve because they're doing it a little bit backwards, whereas the ownership has said, we're going all in on these couple of players and we're going to spend $500 million on a team. And then people look at the Rangers and say, well, they're still not going to be very good. What's the point? But really what the Rangers are doing is building the core of their team, knowing that the rest of their talent is finding its way to the big leagues this year, next year, the following year. So I love what they've done. I love the core that they've built. And I do. I love the talent they have coming up. So I don't think they're there this year. I think the Mariners and the Astros are probably better teams in that division. But I think the future is very, very close to them. I love the way they've done it. And Rangers fans should be excited. And this is really the first year where I think you can get excited with a completely revamped rotation, some of the prospects coming up. They're in a good place.
I'll be there Thursday on opening day. Okay, lastly, let's talk about players. Good, bad, ugly. I know you love Shohei, and I don't know why, honestly, you wouldn't love Ohtani.
Who wouldn't love him? I mean,
beyond
look,
good.
Yes.
Beyond good. Hey, okay, here's the question, because I know I didn't put a question mark at the end of that statement. Generational? Like, all time? Like, what are we looking at with Ohtani?
You know, I think when you start having that conversation of a generational talent. Let me start over. Generational talent, absolutely. Now, are we going to be talking about Shohei Ohtani as the best of all time? That's where the question gets interesting because you look at the conversation of best of all time and it longevity comes into play there. And then especially in baseball with the history so deep, accolades come into play there. Winning comes into play there. And the accolades, I think, will rack up for Shohei. Winning, who knows? Time will tell. But he's done what he's doing right now for a period of 2 to 3 years. And what we've seen in that 2-3 years is the greatest talent that the game has ever seen. If he does that over the course of a decade, we could be talking about the greatest ever. But what we're seeing right now is the greatest talent that the game has ever seen. And I that's why, you know, I think when I look back, there might be people out there that say I talk about Shohei too much. To those people, I would say, fast forward 50 years from now, I'm going to be the guy that talked about the greatest talent the game has ever seen when we were watching it. And I feel just fine about that, you know? So I think it's a two-part question. Most talented, yeah. Best ever, we can have that conversation in a decade.
I really like what you're committed to saying, to not saying you were looking in the rearview mirror. You were looking out the windshield at Shohei Ohtani, capable
exactly.
of calling it as you saw it. I really like that, Ben. All right, my before we go, my two producers are huge baseball fans. Let me ask you a couple of self-interested questions on their behalf. One of them wants me to ask you about George Kirby with the Mariners. Is he from Rye? Is it because my producer's from Rye, New York? Why is he wanting me to ask you about George Kirby?
I think George Kirby like breaks out this year. And I say that because I think he's already a good talent in the league, but I think this year he emerges as a top tier starter. Now it's hard mm-hmm. in that rotation with like Luis Castillo and Logan Gilbert and Robbie Ray, But I think we're looking at a guy that's going to be in this league for a long time and the ace of a staff at some point in his career. I love that guy. I do.
Yeah. He's from Rye, by the way. So there's why we're asking. Producer from Rye, sense. New York. You mentioned the Braves earlier. We talked about the Braves. I think I know where you are on the Braves. You're number two in your power rankings. You do see them as the elite in the National League up against, I don't know, a tier that includes the Padres for the World Series. You didn't kind of finish your thought, complete your thought on the Yankees. Which is kind of an interesting wild card. I mean, we know they're going to be good. The question is, are they good enough?
Yeah, I think that is the question. And I think constantly going into every year, the Yankees are maybe slightly overrated in the public eye. And especially right now with their rotation not looking good. I mean, they've been depleted with injuries. And then let's dive into this offense. That's okay. You want to talk about the Yankees offense? You have Aaron Judge, who broke the American League home run record last year. Can we expect that this year? Probably not. Then look around the lineup. It's the same offense that got swept by the Houston Astros in the ALCS and looked terrible. I mean, what have they added? Anthony Volpe, their rookie shortstop, made the team, so he's going to be an addition there and maybe a shot of excitement into the locker room. But is Anthony Volpe the reason the Yankees are going to win a World Series? I don't think so. So you really need to start diving into the conversation of, okay, the Yankees are one of the most well-known organizations in the world. Now, they haven't been to a World Series in well over a decade at this point. So why do we continue talking about the New York Yankees like they're some juggernaut of the league when really they haven't gotten to a World Series in forever? And I look at their offense right now, and how is it vastly improved from last year when they got their doors blown off in the ALCS? It's not. It's not at all. So I love the addition of Carlos Rodon. It's exactly what they needed. Now he's hurt. He's dealing with an injury that you never want to hear. A strain in his arm, not great. Severino starting the year on the IL. They have a lot of question marks in the rotation. They didn't add much offensively. So for me with the Yankees, I'm sitting here saying they're a good baseball team. Are they one of the elite of the elites in the league right now? No.
Is there anybody in the American League besides the Astros that belong in that conversation, the elite of the elite?
No, I would put the Blue Jays roster in that conversation, but the Blue Jays can't be in that conversation until they prove it. And that's similar to the Padres on the other side of the league is, well, okay, the roster's great. When are you going to prove it? And the Blue Jays have one of the best offenses in the game, top to bottom. Their rotation's going to be very good. They have a good closer back into the bullpen. All the pieces are there to be one of the game's elite, but I have to put the Astros in their own tier because they've proven everything they have to prove over the last decade. They've proven they can win in the playoffs. They've proven they can win in the World Series. They've proven their talent knows how to win in the playoffs. Blue Jays haven't done any of that. I think they're going to be a great team. But until they prove to me that roster can compete in the playoffs with the game's elite, then I can't quite put them in that top tier yet. But roster-wise, they're there.
I don't know if there is one yet, but there's going to be an awesome documentary made about the Astros. Like I don't know what is the 30 for 30 or the HBO documentary is yet, but there's going to be a great one about, as you said, this dynasty. Man, this has been a fun conversation. Ben Verlander, it's good to know you, man. Thank you for jumping on the Will Cain podcast.
No, I appreciate you having me on. This has been a blast of a conversation, so thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ben Verlander. If you think it's so well-deserved, please give us a 5-star review. Share this podcast with your friends. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.